We're talking to Carlos Brooks, who just directed Burning Bright, which we just recently reviewed here on Upcoming Discs. And I want to welcome you to Upcoming Discs, Carlos.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Hey, listen, can you tell me a little bit about your background first before we get into this movie? What pathway took you into filmmaking, bud?
You know, when I was a teenager, I guess this is a typical story. I started with kind of, you know, the 8mm camera that we found in the attic and tying my friend onto the roof of his dad's car and making a superhero movie out of that. And somehow that got me into USC Film School.
Right.
Where I studied writing, actually, for 4 years, screenwriting.
Okay.
And I got out and I wrote, and I always wanted to direct. You know, I grew up in Seattle, and I came down to Los Angeles to go to school, and it took a while, maybe 10 years, 10, 12 years, and I finally wrote a script that got me some financing. Some people got behind me, and that was called Quid Pro Quo.
Right.
And we took that to Sundance, fortunately enough, and had a nice premiere there, and then we ended up, I got sent the script about this girl and a tiger.
Well, that sounds pretty good. So then you ended up writing your first direction effort, which was Quid Pro Quo.
Yes.
So what was that like? Tell me, what's the first day like on the set of the first time you're directing a film? What's that like?
Don't look stupid. That's what it's like. It's like, well, I'll tell you exactly my first day of my first movie.
Uh-huh.
It was a process trailer, which means a big truck that drags a car because it was a family driving through a massive field of tulips.
Right.
Only there are no tulips because we're in New Jersey. So we're going to shoot the tulips later. We're going to put them in. So now add green screen, to both sides of the car.
Right.
And all these lights and everything. Now have the grip truck break down on the New Jersey Turnpike at 4:30 in the morning.
Oh, man, I've been on that turnpike. It's a mess.
Okay, you know. So I got there at 5:30 in the morning, and we're not ready for the first shot. We don't even have a grip truck. So this is my first day. I'm shooting a green screen process trailer. I've got 28 different setups that I've got to pull off to make this work. Because it's going to ultimately be a car crash. You know, I want to find the guy who scheduled this for the first day of my first shoot, had a long talk with them. Needless to say, I ended up having to cut that shoot that day down to 13 setups, and, you know, I got away with the skin of my teeth, but sometimes if things are absolutely over-the-top bad enough, it actually can make you look better.
Right.
Just for not going fetal and crying like a baby. You know, you can succeed.
Sure. Now, what did you learn from that shoot that you now carried on to Burning Bright, which we're talking about for here?
That's an interesting question. From shooting my first movie, which I wrote, I learned the value of fewer takes and more setups. Now, that means having fewer, you know, we'll take one, maybe two or three takes for the actors at the most.
Right.
And moving on to the next setup with your camera, which setups require time.
Exactly.
You know, and they require your crew to move. It's like you turn the wheel of the battleship and everybody starts moving into that new direction.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard to go back. So I learned that better than burning all my time doing take after take after take with the actors,
right,
on a low-budget movie, I would rather have fewer takes and more setups, so that when I get into the editing room and I open up a bin and I look in there to see how, well, okay, we're going to cut this scene together, how many shots do I have? Instead of, like on my first movie, frequently I would find two shots. On Burning Bright, I would open up a bin and I'd have five or six different shots. And when you've got five or six different shots to cut with, you've got that many more options.
And you can almost rewrite the movie in that editing room with that many shots, couldn't you?
You absolutely have to. You know, if you get into a jam, especially a movie where you've got a tiger and you're not sure what parts of the tiger work and what parts of the tiger don't work,
right,
you know, and emotionally, what parts of the story is emotionally working, because when you're playing with suspense, that's an overriding element.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very tricky thing to make sure that the story is as emotional as you can make it when you've got suspense going on as well.
Absolutely.
Because if you don't care about them emotionally, there is no suspense. So you want as many options as you can to make sure the story is as flexible as it can be. You know, you just don't know which way you're going to have to move. That's a football that can bounce many different directions.
Sure. Now, you talked about the movie being, brought to you this girl with a tiger, but it seems to me when you look at it, you're almost playing the girl in that rock and a hard place between the tiger and the hurricane, but you had to have expected or suspected at some point that this tiger was going to take the wind out of the sails of that hurricane, that's where the, you know, we almost forgot about the hurricane, quite honestly.
Right. So, is there a question?
Well, yeah. I was just going to say, when you put these two situations together, did you expect that to happen? And you know, so what was the idea with the hurricane?
Well, I saw them as hand in hand, but I thought that the hurricane would be the sort of harmonic background to the melody line, which would be the tiger.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, the reason for her getting locked in there, so it served a plot purpose, obviously.
Sure, it's acting as a MacGuffin. Or in a way, it's part of the MacGuffin. You know what made this whole thing happen, and I thought that the obvious thematic elements were really interesting. That and in fact, the very opening of the movie is kind of a guttural thunderstorm. You know, in the middle of a black, sort of smoky, steamy cloud, and you realize you're in the middle of the hurricane.
Right,
and yet. The thunder that we use is actually samples of actual tiger and other animal growls that have been turned into thunder. So that kind of thematically expressed, I thought, the relationship between, you know, the storm and the tiger, which is, in fact, they both are really, in some ways, the same thing. It's just raw, unbridled nature.
Now, what about the autistic boy? Is he there for emotion, giving your lead character someone to protect? What was your thinking there?
That was something that the writers and the all came up with early on, and I think it was for them something that made it that more challenging for her. Mm-hmm. And I saw the reason why I saw that as a valuable element is because if you don't have him being as dependent as he can possibly be, and still be 10 or so,
right?
Then you don't have as much drama.
Mm-hmm.
Then her decision to stay or go from his life becomes a lot more easy.
Right.
So that was how that worked. It was there as a foil against her character being able to do what she wanted to do, both thematically and then during the hurricane and the tiger hunt.
And I said in my review, you didn't go in some obvious directions, which I enjoyed about the film. And I have to tell you, as soon as I saw the autistic boy in some of these stairs, the first thing that came to my mind is, now this kid's going to end up with some supernatural connection to the tiger in the end, and that's what I was afraid this was going to turn into. Was that ever discussed, or was that never part of the film?
We joked about it.
Yeah?
Yeah, okay. We joked. We had the same fear you did.
Yeah, because that's where the average film of this type was going to go. The kid was going to have some kind of connection. He'd face off with the tiger, and he'd stare the tiger down with his autistic superpowers.
Exactly. Yeah, that would have been, I think, taxing our ability to suspend disbelief beyond an already very taxed measure.
Yeah. And let's talk about the cast here. Garrett Dillahunt, it seems to me, and I mentioned this again in my review too, that he plays this almost as a deadpan. He's not very emotional when you see him. He's sort of like got this dead stare most of the time. Whose idea was that, and what was the thought process behind that?
That's probably my thinking. I tend to go a little bit more low key and let the audience come into the character rather than paint with a big brush and sort of like run the risk of having an audience scoot their chair back away from the screen because somebody's bouncing up and down so much. So I tend to sit on them. It's a short way of saying it.
Mm-hmm.
And Garrett had only a couple days to pull that part off. He flew in, and I had him about an hour after his plane landed after a red eye.
Oh, boy.
And
so he was tired.
Say again?
So he was tired.
He was tired. And that worked to my advantage. You know, you're making these movies on the fly. In this case, I had 15 days with the actors and only two or three with Garrett, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And I incorporated his predilection. He came naturally sort of exhausted, and I kind of incorporated that into his character and made that work in a way that he could kind of explore creatively.
Sure.
And it created this different style of a bad guy, which I dig.
Mm-hmm. No, you absolutely did. Now going on to Brianna, is it Evigan? Is that how she pronounces
it? Yeah, Brianna Evigan.
Right. Getting on to her, now, I have to tell you, and I said this in my review as well, you've got the best performance that I've seen come out of this young star to date, and I've got to ask you the question. You must have seen something that you brought out. You must have seen something that the rest of us may not have seen. What did you see when you cast this girl, and how did you get such an emotional performance out of an actress who really didn't have a lot to work with probably on the set?
I met her. On my first movie, Quid Pro Quo, I cast for 11 months, and that was an arduous process, and I learned how auditioning people can be great, and I learned how it can be really a waste of time.
Right.
And Brianna, I simply sat down with her one afternoon over a cup of coffee, and after about 35 minutes, if I remember, I hired her. Because I had learned by then, at least from my comfort level, I don't speak for any other director, but I knew that what she had inside of her is what I needed for this movie. And that was the most important thing to me. I had never seen anything she had even done. It may sound strange, but I really believe in intuitive gut, you know, filmmaking, that if I have a visceral response to somebody that I just met, well, when you go to a movie, it's like going on a date. When you're kind of on a date with me, and you're kind of on a date with the actors, you know, right. And you sit right down, and it's the same kind of thing, you know, that first impression, that first reaction, what I have when I meet the actor, that's pretty much what you're going to have when you meet her. And whatever it is that I saw inside of her, I can count on that being something that you're going to see inside.
Right.
So,
what about this reaction to nothing?
Oh, her playing to nothing.
Yeah, I mean, she did such a great job. I mean, you just can't believe that there's nothing really there.
Well, you know, it's amazing what you can do. If I tell her you cannot open a door slow enough, it's amazing how much more scared she'll be.
Right.
When she opens that door. And then as you just keep building on that, and someone's coming around the corner, or she's ducking under a table, it's just fun. I think we created something that was it's like ESP. It's like something that did not exist. We created it in her mind, for sure. And I was able to tap into that thing once it was alive in her head. And I don't know when that happened, but when it was alive in her head, she's not acting. You know, she really is. Afraid. She really, because the thing lives inside of her head, and she's letting it naturally guide her. That was really fun, and I don't know exactly when that happened, but you have her open a door slow enough times, she begins to believe that this is really serious.
Well, and you can tell, and I have to say that if this girl goes on to some decent stardom, this is going to be the movie that people are going to look back and say, this is the breakout role. I know she's been in some big things before, but this is the one where I think you really see what the girl's capable of.
I think she could do such a kick-ass action hero, you know?
Yeah.
I have two daughters, and my wife and I looked at the movie. We haven't seen it in months, and since Lionsgate released it, we watched it for fun. And we both thought, you know, I'd really be proud to have my girls see this movie when they're old enough, because this is a young woman who's not screaming and being an idiot and running around just for the sake of the guys looking at her, although that's certainly fun, and she's beautiful, and she's great, and she's got this core strength. And intelligence, you know, she uses her wits. I think she could really have a career. I absolutely believe in her. I think she will.
Excellent choice. Now, of course, we have to talk about the Tigers. Any close calls?
They got loose.
Okay.
You know, that's scary. When the guy who's in charge of them, the head trainer, starts screaming, that's the only time I ever felt a little uncertain. Although we shot on a big sound stage and
right.
All the doors were sealed, so there was nowhere for the Tiger. I guess everybody outside was safe. But, you don't want to. One of the assistant trainers tried to grab a Tiger when it got spooked by the pots and pans over the stove.
Oh.
And they don't like things above them, apparently. It's like in the jungle, that's where they're vulnerable. And so the Tiger leapt down, and one of the trainers grabbed it by the neck, trying to hold it back.
Oh.
And that made the head trainer, you can imagine a man with his arms wrapped around the neck of this big Tiger. The difference in their head sizes is about 4-1.
Right.
And the head trainer just freaked out. He was screaming, and he left. So the Tiger got loose. The next thing I knew, the Tiger was running right past me and my crew, who were two rooms away. And there's a couple other times a Tiger, you battery chute scene, we built a big tube to shoot down, and a big baffle, which is a big, huge board that was protecting the top of the tube and making
right.
it so that the tiger would have to look up from underneath the tube and not just jump up on top of this 12-foot scaffolding that we were on. Sure enough, I call action, and we let the tiger go, and the cameraman's looking down the tube, and he says, I don't see him, where's the tiger? That's because the tiger has jumped up and is now, well, I guess I said this on the DVD.
Yeah, but, on the making of, yeah.
Tiger was looking right at him. He was able to she was able to jump 16 feet onto the top of that scaffold.
Wow.
That was the close one.
Well, I'll tell you, they were beautiful animals, and I have to give a shout-out credit to both your editor, who made it look at times that the actress and the tiger were in the same scene together when, of course, they couldn't be, and also to your cinematographer, who made them look so beautiful, terrifying, but beautiful.
Yeah, that's Miklos Wright is the editor. He's fantastic. And Michael McDonough is my cinematographer on both my movies. And, yeah, those guys, they were champs. They really nailed it. You got to have good people if you're going to hope to get out alive, you know, and they definitely are great.
Well, like I said, together, I think they added elements to this movie that are just those kind of things that you just can't plan on, that just happen because of someone's skill or their artistic ability.
Oh, yeah. This movie definitely was made by people who were hungry to make a good movie and take a challenge of taking some crazy, bizarre idea and making it something that people would really actually enjoy and get involved in. I mean, it was a real passion for people, which I really admire. A lot of people were skeptical about this movie going in. And
I was.
So easy. Yeah, it's easy to be skeptical about it. I think what got us over the hump was the fact that people, really earnest, talented people, took it seriously. And so I think there's value and quality in that. That's incredible. You just can't. Mm. When you do that with anything you work on, I think there's something that comes out that's intrinsically valuable and good. And it comes from the hearts of the people who make it.
Any chance it'll be out in HD?
Good question. Don't know.
Because this movie really could use
Lionsgate.
Yeah, this is the type of movie that I'd love to see those tigers in HD and see some of that work in HD.
Oh, yeah. That would be beautiful.
Yeah. Well, a couple of just quick last questions. Meatloaf is a cameo. Is that an inside joke? A guy named Meatloaf in a man-eating tiger movie?
I love meat. You know, he goes by meat. I guess that might be Mr. Loaf to you. I'm
not okay.
Sure.
Mr. Loaf.
he's just a wonderful, wonderful guy. He's really terrific. No, that was just him loving the scene that we wrote for him and saying, sure, I'll come up and I'll shoot it.
Yeah, that was I don't know, I got a good laugh out of that. Mostly, I think, because of the name, and we're talking about man-eating tigers.
That's right.
So what's next up the road for you? What's coming up?
I have a script that I just went out with as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very, very huge, and nothing that I'm going to direct. So that's been occupying my time since I finished Burning Bright. But the next thing for me directing is, believe it or not, a straight-ahead drama.
Okay.
That's about all I can say.
Okay.
It's working with some really, really, really terrific people that we've brought on, and we are almost financed, but it's a little hard right now. It's tough to find. It's tough to get money for a straight-ahead drama these days. But we'll get there, and hopefully we'll be shooting in about 5 months.
Well, I hope you'll keep us in mind, keep us up to date with what's going on. We'd love to tell the folks what you're doing.
Absolutely. It's been great talking to you, Gino.
Yeah, listen, I appreciate you squeezing me in. I know you're awful busy, and I appreciate you you helping us out here a little bit. And we enjoyed Burning Bright, and I recommend it to my readers and listeners.
All right. Thanks very much. I'm glad you did.
You take care.
All right, you too.
All right, bye.